Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:16 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 7th. We had a very strong day on stock markets in here today. The Dow Jones was up about 1,500 points, and that is at least confirming a near-term low. So we have a higher reaction low now. We also have a higher high. So we have a low of at least near-term significance. The significant decline from just under 30,000 to 18,000 in the space of about 4 weeks has given way to at least a reversionary rally. So when we look at that on a longer term basis, we can see that the industrials isn't really an industrials index, but it had been encountering or finding support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average on medium term corrections, and it has declined significantly back below that level. When we look at a broader index like the S&P 500, it's now right in the region of that 1,000-day moving average, and it could potentially push back above it. When we look at the NASDAQ 100, then it is now coming back up towards the 200-day moving average, having confirmed support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Therefore, from the perspective of anyone who'd been invested in the mega cap shares that dominate the NASDAQ 100, this pullback has been a medium-term correction. For people who have been investing in small caps, this has been a crash and a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. But small caps are also now starting to bounce in here. When we then look at the commonality that small caps in the USA have with the significant pullbacks that we have in Europe, then the charts are almost identical. We've seen extremely abrupt pullbacks. We've also seen that long-term sequences of higher major reaction lows have been broken, and that this condition is universal to the majority of indices outside of the NASDAQ 100. So what we have seen in the course of the last month has been an acute concentration of performance in a really very limited number of shares. And then if we look at the FANG index, well, this is a mix of both US and Chinese shares, but it is now in fact back above its 200-day moving average. When we look at the constituents, it is weighted by Tesla, Netflix, Nvidia, and Amazon as the biggest weightings. Now, it's an equal weighted index. It's I believe it is reweighted on a quarterly basis, but this is a clear indication that what we are now seeing is a very clear concentration of investing in the technology sector, because on the one hand, the technology sector is less influenced by person-to-person interactions and therefore isn't going to have the same kind of negative impact from economy shutting down and lockdowns underway in the majority of countries. Most of the action or the revenue that they generate is done online. For Nvidia, which is a graphics card producer, then the fact that it has bounced from the region of the trend mean and is now back in the region of its peak from 2018 and earlier this year is also a confirmation that where we're looking at in terms of the evolution of technology is certainly more in terms of demand for graphics cards. That's particularly true when we look at Facebook, which has just inked a deal with Plessy in the UK for augmented reality and virtual reality headsets. And certainly Facebook has been doubling down on their initial bet on Oculus to deliver that kind of product range and also content. The share continues to bounce from the region of that $150 area. Google has also continued to hold the $1,000 level and is currently unwinding its short-term oversold condition. Apple has also just inked a deal with a content provider for both augmented and virtual reality. I think the most important thing that Apple has done has been to demonstrate again that it can find support in the region of a previous peak. In fact, that has been the primary consistency characteristic of the trend over the course of the last decade. And every time it has pulled back to a previous peak, it has represented a buying the dip opportunity. Well, this is, I think, one of the biggest takeaways here, that for buy the dip investors, provided they have concentrated their efforts in the leading shares over the course of the last decade, then buying the dip continues to work. They have almost universally bounced. And Amazon, having pulled back from the upper side of its range on Wednesday of last week, has recouped the entire decline and is now within $2.40 of the $2,000 per share range, which was the upper side of the range for over a year already. Now, when we look at Amazon on a logarithmic scale chart and just look at the consistency of the trend over the course of the last decade for an unleveraged investor, it paused at 100, it paused at around 150, it paused at 200, 400, it paused at about 700, 900, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000. And it has been pausing around 2,000 since September of 2018. In all that time, it has continued to find support in above the 1,000-day moving average. It has never sustained a move below it since 2008. And Amazon has been the buy-the-dip share over the course of the last decade. If it can sustain a move above 2,000, it wasn't quite able to achieve that feat back in February, but if it can do it now, then the argument that we are coming towards the end of this corrective phase for the better performing shares will, I think, be much more convincing. But obviously, we are still going to have a rather considerable period of support building for the majority of other shares. When we think about what are the challenges, well, they're most heavily focused in the mortgages sector. And when we look at the downtrend we've seen in some of the mortgage servicers over the course of the last 6 years, then they'd already been contending with narrower margins. But the decline we've seen in just the last month has been really quite acute. When the CARES Act has provided consumers with a free pass to forego paying their mortgages for anything up to 3 months and potentially even longer, then that introduces clear moral hazard. But perhaps more importantly than that is that it moves the onus for paying mortgages up the ladder of or the credit ladder. And now servicers are on the hook to meet coupon payments. And of course, if they don't pay those coupon payments, then it moves up the line to the people who own the mortgage bonds to make the distributions to their pension holders, for example, or indeed to the Federal Reserve itself, who has been buying mortgage bonds at a very accelerating rate. Well, that pretty much ensures that when Jay Powell said they will do whatever it takes, this is what it means. It means that they're going to have to provide a great deal of liquidity to the mortgage origination sector, and certainly to the mortgage servicers, because without some sort of faith that people will pay their mortgage and that the mortgage issuer will have recourse to foreclosure if they refuse to, then there isn't going to be a mortgage lending market. And if there's no mortgage lending market, then you are looking at a situation where property prices could come down in a very accelerating manner. Therefore, it is inevitable that we're going to get additional money coming through. And I think this is by far the most important point. There are very clear risks. Certainly not every sector can be saved. There are going to be defaults. There is going to be a number of companies that are downgraded into junk. Among those are going to be some of the most overly levered balance sheets. But provided the liquidity is provided by central banks to ease the burden on the people that are and that are going to take the losses, or the portions of the financial sector that are going to absorb those losses, then we don't have to have a very deep recession as a result of it. There are, I think it is quite clear that the cruise liner sector shouldn't be saved, not least since most of their ships are listed elsewhere. Then the hotel sector is obviously very highly levered. There's been a lot of movement in and out of private equity. Hilton Hotels, for example, was privately owned, then it was private equity owned, then it was listed on the stock market. So when we look at just how much debt do they have, I think it is also worth differentiating between the hotels and the vacation clubs. Vacation clubs are basically timeshares, although they don't necessarily function as a timeshare any longer, and they're more like points clubs. Hilton Hotels has debt to assets of about 63%, and they don't report debt to common equity. They don't report a price to book either. So the question then is, exactly what are we seeing in terms of their fundamentals? But one thing we certainly know is that the price has just about halved, and it has rebounded in a pretty dramatic fashion off the lows from the middle of last month, and we are potentially now seeing a higher reaction low. When we think about the vacation clubs, well, the vacation club market certainly takes a big upfront fee when people buy the timeshare, but then they take a month or an annual contribution or a servicing fee. So these are all pre-sold, and then the company picks up the management fees. Well, we certainly saw that it came down from 35 to 15. Obviously, if people stop paying their mortgages, they're quite likely to also stop paying for these discretionary items. So the big question is, how deep is the recession likely to be? And perhaps more importantly is, how long does it last? Because many people can last a month without getting a paycheck. They may even be able to last 2 months. But if it stretches out beyond 3 or 4 months or 5 months, then people start to come under really quite severe financial stress. I do notice that the Zoom meeting notifications I've been getting from my favorite gym instructor last week were saying that donations were welcome, and he changed the way he was saying it this week to saying that he was looking for necessary donations. So you can already see that the stress that is coming through in terms of the service sector is really quite acute for people that are not getting wages from their proposed employer. The fact of the matter is that there are a lot of businesses have been outsourcing to other companies their cleaning or their occasional employments or employment sectors like gym instructors or cleaners. Well, they're not paying those people's wages, and neither are the contractors that take these people on. So there's a significant number of people are not getting any kind of assistance from their employer in here today. Well, that's obviously going to have an impact on the economy. It's going to have an impact on consumption. So just because we're seeing the technology sector continuing to outperform, it does not mean that we're going to avoid a recession. There's certainly going to be a recession. Now let's think about how long the recession will last. Well, the coronavirus is potentially peaking this week in a number of cities. Certainly the fact that Boris Johnson is in hospital and now in intensive care is weighing on the pound somewhat, and the pound was down in here today by about 29 ticks, but it has rebounded in a pretty dramatic fashion. And the lockdowns have certainly helped to contain the exponential pace of the spread. Now let's think about, well, how do you unwind the lockdown? Well, it would be very good to know how many people, in fact, have antibodies. All of those people can leave lockdown immediately. So that means we need much more testing. And testing is likely to ramp up significantly over the course of the next month. But then the number of people who have in fact been infected is still comparatively small. And those that have not been infected are still liable to be infected. And that means social distancing is probably going to be in place for a prolonged period of time. So that also means that we're likely to see a reasonably slow pace of the economy opening back up, and that there is going to continue to be a focus on a lot of online activity for conducting business, conducting education, and communication. So that is also one of the reasons why the technology sector is outperforming. But it also means that we're going to see a very significant spike in unemployment, and then we'll get a pop back on the upside from people returning to work, but that subsequent to that, the pace of unemployment coming back down could be quite slow. There are obviously also going to be a lot of people completely leaving the workforce. One of the reasons why unemployment figures were able to continue to rise over the course of the last decade was because of baby boomers staying in the workforce longer. And a number of those people may simply refuse to come back to the workforce after this recession. Well, that also removes a source of workers. It turns people that were being productive into non-productive members of society, and that also represents an economic headwind. So these are, I think, some of the things that will result in a slower pace of economic activity resuming, even after we get what are going to be some very big moves in unemployment rising and then falling immediately afterwards. One thing that we need to also pay attention to is what's happening in China. Well, the Chinese markets were closed in here today, but they are still dealing with sporadic outbreaks of the coronavirus, and they still want people to wear their masks. Singapore has now had to engage in a greater or a more intense period of lockdown because the number of cases has started to rise again. So the one thing that we need is a vaccine, and we're unlikely to get a vaccine for about a year. The company that is ahead of the rest in terms of delivering a solution is Moderna. This is a company that has been trying to develop a, I think it's an mRNA sequencing and an intervention program for nearly a decade. So they are rapidly being able to get into or get out of phase one trials and potentially into phase two trials within the next 3 months. It's quite likely that they are going to be the first company to market with a vaccine. When we think about, well, what can we anticipate from these massive reactions against the prevailing trend? It is the base case that after a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, you get a period of right-hand extension. And the rationale for that is that you get the big pullback. People look around and they say, well, what's really changed? And the animating force behind this market has been the massive provision of liquidity over the last decade. That has not changed. In fact, it has been amplified. So therefore, some people are going to say, let's buy the dip. And that has worked best in the technology sector. Then there are going to be people that say, well, golly, valuations have improved a lot and we've got a lot of liquidity around. So this is a really quite attractive environment for dividend paying stocks, for example. And the dividend aristocrats have continued to rebound, because the yields that they offer are higher than they've been in years. So people are buying the dip in those kinds of shares. When then we look at those would be the two most bullish characteristics, but a range doesn't form when everything is bullish. So buybacks are being cancelled left and right. So that is removing a source of demand from the market. Then we have to think about institutional investors. Well, some people will be eager to put money to work. But then there are going to be other people who are going to say, well, they just need to stop buying in order to assess the situation. So that's also removing a source of demand from the market. So that is a neutral condition. Then there are going to be people who have been under really quite acute financial stress and have been really quite scared, not just by the volatility that we've seen over the course of the last month, but also because of the volatility we saw at the end of 2018. They'll look at what was increasingly looking like a maturing cycle prior to this big pullback, and they will be thinking that they will use any significant rally to lighten up on their portfolios. And that would, of course, be a source of supply coming into the market. Well, all of those factors playing off against one another suggests that we are still going to see a continued rebound in the stock market. The S&P 500 is now back above the 1,000-day moving average, and it may yet go right back up and test the 3,000-point level. But after that, we still have the fact that we're in a recession, and there are going to be some significant headwinds in terms of the overall economy, and not least because of illiquidity in the property markets, in the mortgage markets, and the also significant dollar funding issues that emerging markets have. Well, one thing that we can certainly see is that it is among the countries that have not received the cross-currency swaps from the Federal Reserve that their currencies have been under the most pressure. As soon as the Federal Reserve gave swap lines to Australia, then the Australian dollar started to rally. And it was finding support today around the 60 cent level. India has not received swap lines, and the rupee remains under pressure. Turkey has been lobbying for all of the G20 to be offered swap lines, but they have not received that just yet. And also, there is a clear bias, I think, in terms of which countries are getting swap lines based upon their how diplomatically close they are and loyal they are to the US administration. So there is certainly the potential that we're going to have debt issues in countries like South Africa or in India or in Turkey. One thing that is different from between India and Turkey and South Africa is India does not have the same number of dollar-denominated loans, and China obviously has the most in terms of dollar-denominated loans. Of course, they're not, though they might be the highest absolute level, but it's not the highest relative to the size of the overall economy. And the renminbi, it was closed in here today, but is still in the region of its lows, but not breaking down to new lows. The dollar index has been extremely volatile over the course of the last month. It's been a weak, then very strong, then weak again, and now rebounding once more. On the one hand, it is pricing in the fact that the only stock market index that is still in a reasonably consistent uptrend is the NASDAQ, and that's a US index with major mega caps in there. It's also the pricing in the flexibility of the US economy and the clear efforts underway to try and ameliorate the economic situation resulting from the coronavirus. Emerging markets are going to probably feel it much more intensely. And when we then think about the success of Greece and Turkey relative to Italy and Spain in containing their outbreaks, well, the sooner a country introduces lockdowns, the better it is in terms of the human toll. But the unwinding of lockdowns still hasn't been done completely effectively. And China is furthest along in unwinding its lockdowns, and yet even there is still a really slow start to economic activity. The fact that the dollar has been firm is, I think, more to do with the fact that there is weakness in other parts of the global economy. The fact that gold is rallying against a background of a firm dollar is a really clear signal that gold is the barometer against which all fiat currencies are measured. And the fact that it is appreciating in all currencies is a clear signal that the massive accommodation that has been unleashed in response to the coronavirus has the potential to create an inflationary bias later, and that gold is, or at the very minimum, that governments are going to try and print their way out of their debt problems and devalue their currencies in the process, and that is why gold remains quite firm. Silver prices were up about 80 cents in here today, and that is breaking up and out of this short-term range. The platinum price has lagged somewhat, but it is firming above the $700 area, so this does look like an environment where we're going to see additional upside for the individual precious metals. The gold miners ETF has also continued to strengthen, and it is coming back up towards the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, the big question for a number of the Mexican miners in particular is that they are the subject of lockdowns, so some of their production is going to be locked in for the foreseeable future. That has been one of the reasons behind the recent inability of Fresnillo, for example, to rally. It's also been trending down now for the last few years because they haven't been keeping up with their own estimates of production. but it's the biggest silver producer in the world, and it's not far off a quarter of the value it put in back in 2016. So if silver continues to rebound, it should be positive for some of these miners. What's also particularly interesting is that the industrial metals continue to rally. And copper prices have continued to hold above the $2 level. The clear conclusion is that despite the threat of recession in the short term, investors are willing to bet that there is going to be a very significant infrastructure build that comes through as a result of this contraction. I think the base case has to be that we are going to see a deep but short recession overall, and that the money that's created is going to create a bull market somewhere. Well, I think we're likely to see an intensification of investor interest in the technology sector. There's certainly going to be demand for dividend-paying stocks against a background of close to zero interest rates just about everywhere. But then there's also going to be a significant investment in infrastructure development. And I think that is likely to benefit the renewable sector in particular. And we are starting to see some support coming through for the solar sector, the wind sector, and also for the hydrogen sector. When, for example, there isn't an ETF for those, but the individual shares have continued to find support in the region of their respective trend means. I think most important chart to pay particular attention to is the 30-year yield. Yields had pulled back in a very dynamic manner during the first portion of March. We are potentially now putting in a higher reaction low. If we're going to have an inflationary outcome, and it certainly cannot be ruled out despite the fact that and because we have to look beyond the fact that the velocity of money has contracted so violently over the course of the last month. If the 30-year yield is pushing back above the 2% level, then that is likely to represent an inflationary bias to investor attitudes. And I do think that we may see that before the end of this year. And that's potentially now what gold's strength is signifying. So I think this is an important market to pay particular attention to. I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.